Emperors of Rome is a listener-supported podcast. To find out more, help keep us on air and get some fairly cool perks. Go to patreon.com/Rome Podcast. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCLI, Tetrarchy. Diocletian and Maximian have established themselves as co-emperors, working together to administrate a sprawling Roman Empire. But with Persians to the east, Britons to the west, and discontent all around, maybe it's time for more laurel wreaths. Here's Kaelin Davenport. I thought it would be good to start this off with a bit of a, for those who came in late. So when we last left Diocletian in the Emperors of Rome, he had gone to Milan. He had met with Maximian, his co-emperor, and they'd properly divided up the empire between them.
Not a formal division, but they...
No. But you manage this part, I'll manage this part.
Yes.
Like a region of responsibility.
Region of responsibility, yes. That's a good way to think of it.
Or culpability,
yes.
Or something like that.
Diocletian is still supreme, but Maximian, you know, you're mainly based in this part.
You take care of the Gauls.
Yes.
So take me through that a bit. What's the division of labour and what situation is the empire in?
Yeah, so Diocletian and Maximian both have the rank of Augustus, though Diocletian is senior Augustus because he was there first and he helped to elevate Maximian. And Diocletian, as you quite rightly pointed out, is mainly based in the east and Maximian mainly based in the west. Though, of course, there is a real challenge to Maximian's authority in that he doesn't control Britain. And also parts of northern Gaul as well, because one of his former military officers, Malzaeus Carausius, has seized power and has set himself up as an emperor there and is even trying to gain recognition from both Diocletian and Maximian. So he's been minting coins with pictures of all three of them on there, styling them as fratres, brothers. So Carausius and his brothers is the message coming out that he is a member of the Imperial College, and Diocletian and Maximian are refusing to recognize him.
It seems to be at this point that there's an agreement that it's a big empire, there's a lot going on, and even with the two of them focusing on the problems, there is the need for more help. So at this time, it's time to elevate even more people in junior positions, but a recognition that the Imperial College needs to grow.
Definitely. So in 293, they create two new Caesars, so junior emperors, Constantius and Galerius. We don't know how long this has been in the planning. It happens on the 1st of March, 293. Both Constantius and Galerius are certainly high up in the hierarchy of the army, and there's even been marriage alliances with Diocletian and Maximian, possibly made, you know, several years before, 5 years or more before in some cases. So it's possibly a long gestating idea which comes to fruition that each Augustus or senior emperor should be assisted by a Caesar or a junior emperor. And of course, you know, this is a major insult to Carausius, who has wanted to be recognized. You know, he's minting coins with the legend, you know, fratres, we're all brothers, and, you know, Augustus, the abbreviation Aug, with three Gs, indicating, you know, there are three emperors ruling. And Diocletian and Maximian are basically saying, no, you're not going to be recognized. We're going to promote these other emperors instead to assist us. So, you know, this is a sign that the emperors are gearing up to finally take on Carausius.
Is it fair to call these two new roles Caesars then?
Yeah. So they had the title of Caesar. So the idea of, you know, the Caesar as subordinate to an Augustus, it has been percolating, you know, for some time. We see, for example, the emperor Hadrian adopted his first heir, Caonius Commodus. He became Lucius Aelius Caesar, you know, because he was going to be the successor. And then when Aelius died, it was Antoninus Pius who became Caesar and then became Augustus on Hadrian's death. And thereafter, then it was, you know, frequently repeated, you know, Geta under Septimius Severus, and then lots of emperors in the third century. So it was a familiar title by now that this is like a second ranking emperor, but also perhaps, you know, an assumption that they would become an Augustus one day.
That is not a fair assumption at any point during the century, I don't think. All right, so tell me about these two new Caesars that we've got in the empire. We'll start with Constantius.
Yeah, so Constantius is a senior army officer. I'm using that vague term because we don't know his exact role. He was probably born about 250, so, you know, in his early 40s by now. And he, like Diocletian and Maximian, was from the Balkan region. He was from the province of Dacia Ripensis, bordering the riverbank. And he began his career as a protector, and that's an army officer, but one who was sort of marked out as special because they served in the field army, so the army that accompanied emperors on their campaigns. So it's very likely because of an allusion in one of the panegyrics delivered at this period that he served under Aurelian's forces in Syria in the war against Zenobia. Listeners might remember that one of the great pieces of contemporary evidence we have from this age are these panegyrics, these speeches in praise of the emperors that are, of course, you know, incredibly positive and often gloss over the negatives, but they do provide hints about their earlier careers. So we have Constantius as a protector and then rising up to be a tribune, a middle-ranking military officer, and then a governor of Dalmatia, and that's probably under Carinus. So he is someone who, like Diocletian Maximian, you know, is cut from the same cloth, worked his way up from the ranks, a really different breed of emperor from the senators we get, you know, first, second centuries and the first half of the third century CE.
And I think it's important to signpost at this point that because of who Constantius is related to later on, to future emperors, that there is a touch of mythology about his dynastic links and what we know about him and the mythology that's built up.
Yes, so he is, spoiler alert, the father of the Emperor Constantine, the first Christian emperor who, you know, really remakes the Roman Empire. And early in Constantine's ascendancy in the 4th century CE, the family is said to have been descended from Claudius Gothicus. You might remember back that Claudius ruled for only about 18 months just before Aurelian became emperor, 268 to 270, that he was a great general. You know, he won a battle against the Goths. A shield was erected in the Senate house, a statue on the rostra before he died of the plague. He was someone who could be claimed as an ancestor because, you know, there wasn't anything controversial about him. He was a great success. And so in one of the later panegyrics, the orator sort of, you know, springs, you know, this news on the audience, you know, that only a few people know this, Constantine, that you're descended from Claudius Gothicus, and now I'm letting everyone know. And so when we look in the Historia Augusta, which is written in the late 4th century, there are stories about his connection with Claudius Gothicus, that Constantius' mother was, for example, Claudius Gothicus's niece. That's all fabrication. I mean, some scholars still try and make it work, but it is almost certainly a lie.
It's a tenuous enough link that it's plausible.
Exactly. And that no one is really going to investigate. He wasn't murdered by his troops as well. So that's always good in the third century.
Yeah, that's the low bar. Yeah. And what about his family? We've signposted that that he is the father of Constantine the Great. Mm. So there's a whole family associated with that, which, wow, we will get into it in future podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. So Constantius was married, we think, to a woman called Helena, and she is the mother of Constantine. And yes, there's a whole, you know, mythology surrounding her. But we're told that she was a stabularia, sort of like a stable girl, probably the daughter of an innkeeper, according to Timothy Barnes. And she knows she was from Bithynia in Asia Minor. So it's likely that Constantius met her when he was in his early 20s on the way to or from Syria on Aurelian's campaigns, and that he stayed at the inn when his troops were put up there. There's a lot of controversy that still continues about whether Helena was Constantius's concubine or whether they were actually married, and scholars are divided, though it is pointed out that all the sources that talk about her as a concubine talk about her in a very negative light, so they may be trying to undermine the legitimacy of their marriage. Whatever her status, and yes, this can certainly be explored in future episodes, they did have a son, Constantine, born around 273 CE in ancient Nisus, modern Nish in the Danubian region.
But importantly for his career, I guess, as a Caesar, he doesn't stay married to Helena, or he doesn't stay with her.
No, does he? No. So he marries again, or he puts Helena aside to marry for the first time. So sometime in the late 280s, certainly before April 289, he marries Theodora, the daughter of the Augustus Maximian. He's already very high in the imperial circle. We hear stories in the panegyrics that he was campaigning against the Germans, even captures one of their kings. We don't know his correct title because it's all very elusive. Constantius marries Theodora, the daughter of Maximian, which of course binds himself in a dynastic union. Now, we're not quite sure what the long-term intention is here. Maximian does have a son, Maxentius. We're not quite sure of his birth date, but, you know, he could be between about 10 and 15, depending on when he was born. So Maximian does have a son, but certainly Constantius is being drawn into the imperial family, we might say, through this marriage.
Maybe it's a sign of what they need in the immediacy. Maybe long-term planning isn't entirely coming into it at this point.
Yes, exactly. You know, at that particular time, you know, Maxentius isn't going to be leading any armies. Mm. And, you know, there are problems in the West. It's not only the Rhine frontier, but also Carausius. And you are going to need a general who is on the scene. And, you know, it's become increasingly the need for that general to be an emperor. Constantius and Theodora go on to have six children, Constantine's half-siblings, and gosh, that causes a lot of problems in about 40 years' time.
Okay, so generally, as I see it, a Caesar gets mentored by one of the Augusti, I'm probably using the wrong terms here, and maybe allocated a bit of territory to be responsible for and oversee. Mm. So where does Constantius end up in the hierarchy and location?
So he is subordinate to Diocletian and Maximian, but he's most closely associated with Maximian because he is also based in the West, largely at Trier in the Northwest. That becomes his major campaigning base. We tend to use the term imperial city to describe these other cities which start to take on the characteristics, really, of Rome, the capital. Sometimes it's called tetrarchic capitals, but a better term for this probably sort of imperial cities. You know, they're used as a base of operations. Palaces are built there. They often have, you know, amphitheaters or circuses where people can display themselves to the public. You know, they have long processional avenues, etc. And Constantius is based at Trier, but it's clear that his mission really is the campaign against Carausius.
And the other Caesar is Galerius.
Yeah. So Galerius is a little bit younger. He's probably born in the late 250s at Romulanium, again in Dacia Rapensis near Sirtica. We know his mother was a peasant. Her name is Romula. And there's quite a bit of invective written about her by Christian authors. We're told that Galerius started off his life as a shepherd before entering the army. This is part of this pattern, you know, Danubian men from very humble backgrounds that enter the army and make their, you know, fame and fortune. We know very little about, you know, Galerius's career compared to, you know, Constantius, you know, gets panegyrics in his honor that survive. And of course, he's associated with Constantine. We have no surviving panegyrics for Galerius, so they certainly would have been delivered. And then a lot of the writing about him is from hostile Christian sources. However, we do know that Galerius married Diocletian's daughter, Valeria. Diocletian didn't have any sons. And so, you know, this is again part of this, you know, uniting of these high-ranking military officers with the family. We don't know exactly the date of the marriage, but it was probably around 288, 289, given that their daughter, Valeria Maximilla, was born soon after. So it is speculated that Galerius was married first or had a concubine, because he does have another son, Candidianus, who appears in our stories later. So he, like Constantius, may have put aside an initial partner in order to marry the daughter of one of the Augusti. So, you know, we're getting this pattern of the sort of people whom Diocletian and Maximian want to share their rule with.
Yeah, and it seems to be very important to them as well to be able to claim a familial link to the Augusti as well by marrying into the families.
Definitely. I mean, often people start to talk about this system like the Tetrarchy as if it's, you know, a repudiation of dynastic links. That's actually not the case, because there's lots of ways in which dynasties can be constructed.
Has this all been a natural evolution, or do you think there's careful planning to establish this at this point as going from a diarchy to a tetrarchy?
This is the $64 million question, is how much is being planned. I think it's an ongoing process. Clearly, the integration of Constantius and Galerius into the imperial family happens, you know, about 4-5 years before they're made Caesar. So the emperors are already thinking about who they want to be allied with. But it is very probable that the setbacks in the campaigns against Carausius, you know, Maximian's failure, may have, you know, hastened the need for like a second generation of emperors to help out there. Because across the third century, there is this clear need for imperial presence, for emperors on the scene. And, you know, Diocletian in the East, you know, he doesn't have a trouble-free time. You know, there's war with Persia, there are revolts in Egypt and Antioch, etc. Having, you know, a junior emperor to assist in the East and be able to put down these fires is very strategically sensible.
So this elevation, it would have been a big event for Rome. There would have been efforts to mark this and record it.
Definitely. So there were two simultaneous elevations in the West and the East, neither of which took place in the city of Rome itself. So that is really significant. So the 1st of March 293 was chosen. This is the birthday of Mars, the god of war, carefully selected. So Maximian elevated Constantius at Milan, giving him the Rome of office, and Diocletian elevated Galerius at Nicomedia in the East. So this was really very carefully choreographed.
And even though there's familial relationships due to marriage and everything, what effort was there to show that this is a unified group?
Yeah, so there's a clear order. So there's two Augusti, Diocletian is the senior. There's two Caesars, Constantius is the senior as well. So there's a clear order in imperial titulature. So we have inscriptions, you know, with the titles of all four emperors, and it always goes Diocletian, Maximian, Constantius, Galerius. And the idea is, you know, to show a united front that all four of them would take the victory titles, regardless of who actually achieved the victory, because the credit of one redounded to them all. Now, it's interesting. So the speeches of the period, and also some inscriptions, styled Diocletian and Maximina as brothers, as fratres. And this is clearly, you know, coming out of the idea of them as military officers, part of this military brotherhood. Byron Waldron talks about this particularly well in his book on the dynasty of the period. They also took on names. So Constantius and Galerius also take Diocletian's name Valerius. This is, you know, their family nomen. There are debates still about whether they were formally adopted or not. But regardless of whether that happened, you know, the message to people who are looking at this family is that they're united. There's also sort of divine unification taking place. Around 288, Diocletian and Maximian took what we call theophoric signa, essentially, you know, God-given names. So Diocletian becomes Jovius, the Jovian one associated with Jupiter, and Maximian becomes Herculius, the Herculean one associated with Hercules. Much is made in the panegyrics of the period of the fact that, you know, Diocletian is now descended from Jupiter and Maximian from Hercules. And these names then carry on to the next generation. Galerius, because he's in the east with Diocletian, becomes Jovius, and Constantius becomes Herculius. And you do see these ideas communicated on coinage. You know, there's a lot of Western coinage which refers to the labors of Hercules, for example, and Jupiter, very prominent in the east, but also on the fibulae, the sort of the brooches which military men wear to fasten their cloaks. You will find, you know, words like, you know, hail Caesar Herculius or something like that, indicating that, you know, this is an idea which is being promoted amongst legions. So there's, you know, this real clear idea that there is this sort of dynastic arrangement here. And as I mentioned, you know, some people have sort of really sort of played down, you know, the idea of dynasty, but, you know, dynasties, as scholars sort of recognize, are cultural constructions. It's not necessarily, you know, someone's, you know, son, you know, it's on their bloodline, you know, there's marriages, there's adoptions, there's, you know, the use of certain names. And so it's clear that this was a dynastic grouping.
I see it as a really kind of careful effort on likely Diocletian's part to keep the group unified. Mm. I mean, nobody plays nice in the 3rd century in Rome. Yeah. The last thing that you want is somebody going, no, Carausius has the right idea. I'm going to go rogue with my little state or try and take over the empire at large.
Yes.
But if there's a real unified effort, a group to say that, no, we four are really, we're family, we're working together, we all share the glory. Mm. Sure, there's a hierarchy involved in that, but nobody seems to be left out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of other attempts to bind sort of non-relatives into an imperial college had failed or are being deliberately torn apart. So, you know, we know when Septimius Severus, you know, makes Clodius Albinus a Caesar, you know, that's just a temporary measure. He's not formally adopted. Clodius Albinus does take the name Septimius, but, you know, then that is rent apart. After Trajan Decius dies, the next emperor, Trebonianus Gallus, keeps Decius's younger son as part of the Imperial College briefly, but then he dies of plague. So, you know, this is the first, you know, real attempt to sort of, you know, bind together different individuals into a coherent Imperial College. And yes, I think it is, you know, the pressures of the 3rd century which are really mandating this need.
And I've read ahead in the notes, I feel that Diocletian is the glue, so...
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, he could have, you know, just ruled alone. He's the one who's choosing to elevate Maximian and then elevate these Caesars as well.
So tell me about the word tetrarchy then, because that's a modern kind of trapping that we've got. They didn't call themselves a tetrarchy, so where does that word become significant in all of this?
Yeah, no, that's a really important point. So yeah, you will see the tetrarchy, the tetrarchs. you will see terms like the first tetrarchy, like we're talking about now. Then you'll have a second tetrarchy and a third tetrarchy. But yeah, these are all modern terms of convenience. So tetrarch is a Greek word, which means, you know, one of four rulers. And you do actually find tetrarchs in antiquity, particularly in the East. So it is a legitimate title. But these particular Roman emperors, they never applied this term to themselves. Bill Ledbetter actually has done a lot of research into the origins of this term. It first appears in German scholarship at the very end of the 19th century. And then we find it trickling into French and English works. And by the 1940s, it's completely common. Everyone is using it to refer to, you know, Diocletian establishing the tetrarchy. But this is like a new system of government. And that sort of sometimes obscures the fact that it is still a dynastic arrangement. They're sort of emphasizing that it's, you know, the choice of the best four men to rule together. But it also gives it sort of this institutionalized gloss. And also, you know, spoiler alert, the so-called first tetrarchy, these four rulers, Diocletian, Maximian, Constantius, and Galerius, only lasts from 293 to 305. And then we do get other sort of attempts to carry it on, but then there's four, then there's five, and there's three, because all these other people want to be involved as well. So look, I think it's fine if we use the term, as long as we recognize that it could provide, you know, connotations of institutionalization, which probably didn't exist at the time, but actually at the time, a lot of sort of family dynastic links were really promoted.
So we've talked about how the Caesars are allocated territory, but how did the administration of the empire from this point forward run practically?
Yeah, so there was no sort of formal division of territory. Sometimes you see in books, you know, this is where Constantius was, this is where Maximian was. It is looser than that, but, you know, basically Maximian and Constantius are based in the west, Diocletian and Galerius in the east, but Diocletian is still supreme, and Diocletian's the one who, you know, will often travel west to Milan and then, you know, even to Rome in 303. Well, we know Galerius never even goes to Rome. Galerius never even sees Rome his entire life, you know, which is, you know, kind of staggering, wow, actually, when you think of, you know, as a Roman emperor. And, you know, there is this hierarchy, as I said, Diocletian, Maximian, Constantius, and Galerius. And so within, you know, this framework, we do get the sense that each of the emperors resides in particular imperial cities, as I said. You know, these are the cities which are their main bases, and this sort of gradual sort of amplification, rebuilding of these cities to make sure they have the right sort of palaces. So, you know, they often have a circus, you know, adjoined to the palace. You can see some of the remains of that, for example, in Milan today, you know, right near to the archaeological museum, past the palace and some of the towers of the circus. You know, often they're adorned with bath complexes, more than just your ordinary baths. There's a real sense that, you know, these are, you know, proper imperial cities in the provinces. So Diocletian mainly in the east, Sirmium when he's in the Balkans, Nicomedia in Asia Minor. He spends a lot of time campaigning in the east, so he's based at Antioch. But certainly from 302, the last couple of years of his reign, Diocletian is based at Nicomedia in Turkey, not far from Constantinople, or what would be Constantinople, it's not there yet, sorry, Byzantium. And the Christian author Lactantius, who is hostile to Diocletian, but Diocletian does make him professor of rhetoric in Nicomedia, talks about the way in which, you know, Diocletian embellished the city in order to make it a second Rome. And one of the most exciting discoveries of sort of the last 10 years is they've found reliefs, colored reliefs from a building showing Diocletian and Maximian embracing, meeting together. It's clear that, you know, this was a really important city. Maximian was then based in the west, so often moves between Trier, Milan in North Italy, Aquileia, eastern North Italy, you know, the gateway to the Danube. He also spends some time late 290s campaigning in Africa. But he does also visit Rome, for example. I think that's something to bear in mind, is that, you know, he's in Rome in 289, 290. 294, 299, and then 303. So, you know, he doesn't ignore the city there. I think that's sometimes forgotten.
He seems to be geographically the closest one as well.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, often Milan and Aquileia in North Italy because they're close to the frontiers, but then also there are major campaigns in Africa as well. And it's when he comes back from Africa, Maximian starts work on the Baths of Diocletian. So they really should be the Baths of Diocletian and Maximian. We call them the Baths of Diocletian, but the inscription tells us it's when, you know, he returns from Africa that construction begins. And members of his family are also born there as well. So that's quite important. Then the Caesars, Constantius really, you know, is mainly based at Trier. And that's because he's got the campaigns against Carausius and on the Rhine. There's that sort of unofficial sort of north-south division in the west there. Trier is well worth a visit. The Porta Nigra, the Black Gate, gives you the sense of the scale of the walls. But then you can also see, you know, the amphitheatre and the bathhouse as well. They have a fabulous museum. So you get a sense of how that is transformed. And then in the east, Galeria sort of moves around as well. Antioch, and then particularly the Balkans, Sirdica and Thessalonica in Greece becomes a major center for Galerius as well. There's magnificent rotunda, which is part of his palace, which still survives, which was converted into a church. And there's really been some stunning new archaeological excavations come out from building the metro, actually, in Thessaloniki as well. So you really find, you know, the real impact of the emperors on the provinces through these constructions.
So you talked a bit about how the cities in particular that they were based in were built up and how there was building activity in Rome. And this is an important thing that an emperor has to do to establish their dynasty, to leave their mark on the cities that they're in and the empire at large. But how did propaganda go into this for the Tetrarchy? And what did they do to really kind of infuse that they are a unified front and working together?
That's something that's really important, because they needed to articulate this to the public, you know, that there would be, you know, one of them somewhere to help them out. So, you know, you have coins which show all four emperors sacrificing before a city gate, for example. You find the titulature, you know, with the titles of all the different emperors, you know, on imperial inscriptions, on imperial letters. But probably the most famous representations that survive today are the statue groups. So the Venice Tetrarchs is the image that comes to mind. So they're made of hard red porphyry, which is quarried in the imperial quarries in Egypt. It is a purple. It's really an identifiably imperial color. And, you know, there were porphyry statues of emperors before this period. Is very much associated with the Tetrarchs in our imagination, because it is used for so many of their statues. So the so-called Venice Tetrarchs, which you can still see today in St. Mark's Square in Venice, you know, they're two pairs of emperors that are shown hugging each other. They're wearing the military cap, the Palaeus Pannonicus, which is, you know, the Pannonian hat. They're holding swords with eagles' heads, their full military uniform. And they're clearly sort of, you know, there's like a porphyry backing to them as well. So we know that these statues were often attached to columns. So sometimes there would be four columns, each topped with an independent statue of the Tetrarch. So we know that was in the military camp at Luxor in Egypt, for example. But other times you had these columns, probably porphyry, with, you know, these two pairs attached to them. Now, the question you probably want to know is how they got to Venice.
It was my next question, yeah.
Well, they were brought there in the sack of Constantinople, the Fourth Crusade, in 1204 CE. So they were military spoils. They probably originally came from Diocletian's capital, Nicomedia. That's probably where they originally set up. And then probably moved to Constantinople, where they have been associated with the sons of Constantine. So, you know, the idea of, you know, imperial images being reused. And it's from there that they were captured by the Western Crusaders and brought back to Constantinople, along with other booty, such as, you know, the gilded horses from the Hippodrome and other, you know, numerous other spoils. But, you know, it's this idea that the emperors, you know, are so tightly bound together that they're hugging each other. This is such an innovation in imperial iconography, because even, you know, with married imperial couples, usually the symbol of unity is, you know, the joining of hands. You know, they're not necessarily shown embracing. So this is a really new visual language which is being employed in order to emphasize, you know, the brotherhood of the Tetrarchs.
It's also an impressive statue in what it conveys, but it's also vague enough that there's debate as to who is which emperor.
Yeah, exactly. So two of the emperors do have beards that are etched into them. There's been a lot of debate about whether that was original or not. The current consensus seems that it wasn't original, so that at some point later that people have sort of etched beards onto two of them because they wanted to convey, you know, seniority for those ones. But yes, you know, it can be repurposed and it can be interpreted in various ways about who exactly is who, because it is, you know, this symbol of unity. And I always encourage my students, you know, if you're going to Venice, make sure you hug a Tetrarch. And because, you know, they're low enough in St. Mark's Square that you can, you know, you can get up close to them. It's a really special experience. And I love when I get photos from students showing them hugging Tetrarchs, you know. They're not lovable at all, really. But, you know, I think it's important to bond with the past. But what is less well known is there are also Tetrarchs in the Vatican as well. These are in the Vatican museums. They're on two porphyry columns. They're much smaller and they're holding globes, if I remember correctly. And they're right near the very end, the last staircase you go out of. I think it's before the gift shop. I haven't been there for a while, but if you turn around, you can't just keep going straight down. You have to turn around when you're on the staircase and look back, and then you'll see the two porphyry columns, each with a set of hugging Tetrarchs there.
Wow, don't hug those ones.
No, they're too high up.
And you might get arrested.
Yes, yeah.
An interesting side. Sorry, this is a porphyry sidebar. Is that they found one of the missing feet in Istanbul in the 1960s, which is interesting.
That's right. Yes, I've seen it. I've seen the missing foot in the. Yes. I forgot all about that. In the Istanbul Archaeological Museum. Yes, yes. It's great to see the sort of missing link as to you know, the journey. You're exactly right. So you have to go to all these different places to trace the story.
Give us a bit of a foreshadow then. This is seems like a good unified group, which is a breath of fresh air for Rome at the time, I guess, after the tumultuous third century that they've had. And this works well until it doesn't.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, it's being set up really to, there was an emperor everywhere where they might be needed, and particularly, you know, Carausius is still looming in the West. I think it's really important to emphasize that Diocletian, if things had gone differently, he could have just ended up like any other third century emperor, but he didn't decide to rule alone. He promoted Maximian, and then he promoted these two emperors to be Caesars. And so, you know, he isn't, you know, going to meet this this terrible fate of these three-month emperors like Quintilius, etc. But also there are some problems built into the system, and that is that Maximian has a son, Maxentius, and Constantius has a son, Constantine, as well. So there is now this potential tension between bloodline and, you know, the selection of other valiant military officers to be part of the Imperial College. And that is really what's going to tear it apart.
That was Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. We're a listener-supported podcast, so thanks to everyone who has helped keep the lights on.
To find out more and get yourself some fairly cool perks, go to patreon.com/Rome Podcast. This podcast was recorded and produced in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.